Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, except there's no Amy today. She's still making her way back from Atlanta after dropping off her eldest, Peyton, at Georgia Tech. So she'll be back in tomorrow. We begin this morning all the fallout from last week's raid, don't call it a raid, on Mar-a-Lago. Merrick Garland's statements on Thursday, no questions. And then the reaction over the weekend. There were a couple of interviews that stood out to me over the last several days before we even get to the particulars of the search warrant that was made public on Friday. One of them was this sort of roundtable Maria Bartiromo had with Kash Patel, who's a former chief of staff for the Defense Department, and Devin Nunez. Bartiromo bringing both of those gentlemen on because those were two of the important people who exposed the Russian collusion hoax for the hoax that it was. And so the background they have, I mean, Devin Nunez, not just House Intel Committee, but two decades in the swamp. He has a feel for it. Kash Patel is a former prosecutor in addition to being a DOD COS. And so just taking a bit of a step back so you can see this perhaps come into focus in terms of what has been transpiring inside the Beltway over the last, well, at least 5 years. Devin Nunez actually takes it back pre-Trump, goes back to Obama, Joe Bama terms one and two. So listen to first Kash Patel reminding you who it is that is a writing point with respect to the Trump investigation.
Basically, the same corrupt FBI government gangsters, the same agents that were involved in Russiagate, the same counterintelligence agents that were involved in making the bad false call on Hunter Biden's laptop, or you're going to see are the same counterintelligence agents that helped raid or assist in the raid to President Trump's home. And why is that a problem? Because these agents knowingly break their oaths of office and the law, get promotions, and we need to demand their names. Guys like Auten and Tybalt and other guys who also stood up to fake Whitmer prosecution in Michigan. When Devin and I first marched down to DOJ to expose the likes of Peter Strzok, they laughed us out of the building. But what happened? He was placed on administrative leave because he broke his oath of office. And you're going to find that exactly is what's happening here. And that it is a counterintelligence investigation means it's being run out of FBI headquarters as a national security case by these same select few of corrupt politicians who are acting as FBI agents.
And Tybalt and Auten, these are the two FBI agents that are the subject of a whistleblower complaint, a letter that was sent to Chuck Grassley. We've discussed this, but I know it's a lot of names to keep track of on your FBI corruption chart. So these were the two agents, focus of the letter sent to Grassley, saying these two agents tried to derail or rat hole the Hunter Biden investigation, claiming that evidence was actually Russian disinformation. Oh, by the way, we have some updates we'll get to probably with Andy McCarthy at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour on those agents involved in the Whitmer case. But you get the point that Patel is making. It's the same crew running the same racket, playing politics with their law enforcement power. Nunez, as I alluded to, takes it back further than Russiagate.
I think this goes back to the IRS scandal where they targeted conservatives. I think it goes back to Fast and Furious during the Obama administration where they ran guns and tried to set people up. You remember, and then innocent Americans ended up getting killed. It goes back to Benghazi. They got away with that. And then you have to remember, it was late 2015 or 16 that we get to the plan where the Clinton campaign, working with dirty cops at DOJ and FBI and the media, I must say, where they set up to spy on the Trump campaign and ultimately Republicans and frame an innocent man that then led to what? So that was the Russia hoax that then led to the Mueller witch hunt. So all of this stuff is intertwined, and then you just fast forward, you know, Cash mentioned, you know, the Whitmer case and Jan 6 and whether or not federal agents were involved in that. So you just stair step, and then ultimately this leads to what? This leads to something never done in American history before. You had a president's home ransacked by the same goons that were involved in all of this. And I would say that you know, a lot of people have criticized, you know, the FBI and the DOJ, and I think rightfully so. But someone are making these calls. And I would say that the people that have been involved in all those scandals that I just listed are the very same people that are now in charge of the DOJ and are at the White House.
And the people he's specifically talking about, Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, Lisa Monaco, who's Deputy Attorney General.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, but Amy's not here. As I mentioned, she's still making her way back from Atlanta, where she dropped her son Peyton off at Georgia Tech to begin his collegiate career, so she'll be back tomorrow. Before Mike Scott's newscast, talking about the release of the search warrant, which doesn't tell you a lot. It's just basically a property receipt, you know, boxes that are have these markings on them with documents that have these markings on them were taken and so on and so forth. As the Wall Street Journal opined, well, that didn't settle anything. Talking about the release of the warrant and the property list. The documents show the FBI carried away 20 boxes of items and memorabilia, 11 sets of classified documents, some of which were marked top secret or higher in classification and required special storage. The list of seized documents does not have details, but of course, there's always the leakers. And the Amazon Post reporting some of the seized items were classified documents relating to nuclear weapons, which we mentioned on Friday. And even if you stipulate that the mishandling of classified information, if that is even true, because the arguments made by Trump that he's been fully transparent, that whatever they're deeming as classified was declassified by him when he was president, which he had the power to do, number one. Number two, the documents taken also perhaps trigger attorney-client privilege issues, perhaps trigger executive privilege issues. And as the journal goes on to opine, it's been 18 months since Trump left the White House. So why the sudden urgency for the descent on Mar-a-Lago a week ago? If the documents were serious nuclear secrets, you'd think the Department of Justice would have demanded their return as soon as that was known. And if such documents are floating around Mar-a-Lago, why tell the world via a leak to the Amazon Post? Yeah. And so we'll get into that. The Espionage Act is cited in the documents that were disclosed. And so the idea of a potential prosecution of Trump under the Espionage Act, if indeed there was proof of mishandling of classified information, is farcical. And as I said, we've got Andy McCarthy at the bottom of the 6 o'clock hour, former federal prosecutor, to talk about that. This idea that that still they persist with essentially saying that Trump is a double agent. Trump is a Quisling. He is guilty of treasonous behavior. That's the direction they're actually taking this. But for those who said, well, this was just a fishing expedition for January 6th, what their real interest is with the raid is January 6th and documents relating to it. Well, as I said last week, that's not the indication, and it was confirmed by the documents released on Friday. And if they were doing that, and that runs counter to the representations they made before the court of law, then you have the same cabal of people perpetrating yet another fraud on a court. If these experts and FBI folks and observers with experience at DOJ and FBI and the intel agency suggest this is really about 1-6, that is not what they documented to the court. That is not what they presented to the court. So is it possible that that's still true and that they committed another fraud in another court the way they committed frauds on the FISA court during the Russian collusion investigation? Sure, it's possible. And this goes back to what I was saying before about this interview with Cash Patel and Devin Nunes that Maria Bartiromo did over the weekend. And Cash Patel, I think, puts his finger right on it when he's talking about these men and women of always, at least with respect to the Joe Obama administration. Your now domestic policy advisor, Susan Rice, who dates back to the first two terms. Jake Sullivan, NSA, dates back to the first two terms. Lisa Monaco, deputy AG, dates back to the first two terms. It's a national security investigation, Cash Patel.
You know, me as a former national security prosecutor in the National Security Division, where this case is being run out of, it's no surprise that the likes of John Carlin, who was the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, who authorized a Russiagate hoax to begin with, is now the number three official at DOJ. And Lisa Monaco is the number two official, who was his superior back then. These folks, and this is the thing I want to stress with, now that this is a quote-unquote ongoing FBI counterintelligence investigation, they will come out to the American public and be able to say, ongoing CI investigation, you will never be allowed to see the Russiagate docs or any other docs that President Trump lawfully declassified, and they will hide it from the public. And Congress has a monumental lift ahead of them. Come November, they better start subpoenaing these documents immediately and putting these people before the American public. Merrick Garland and FBI Director Chris Wray have failed in their mission to uphold the law. They have become political hucksters, and they are completely destroying our Constitution and putting on a two-tier system of justice.
That about sums it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And again, since we have some institutional memory on this show, I mean, this is exactly what we went through with the Russian collusion investigation. With Adam Schiff and others, but particularly Schiff, ever present on cable news programs, talking about evidence they were at some point going to present, smoking guns that they had with respect to Trump's colluding with Putin that never materialized. You do a Mueller report, you have various interpretations of some aspects of it that the left can grab hold of, their comm shop, the DC press corps can grab hold of, make it murky enough that he may have done something wrong, but it didn't quite rise to the level of, and then everybody moves on. Well, everybody may move on, but those men and women of the last 15 years of the three Joe Obama administrations, they have not moved on. They're still there, and they're still plying their trade, and some of the names have changed, and many of them haven't. Many of them haven't. This was an interest. This is the other interview I mentioned that I wanted to get to. Former FBI Deputy Assistant Director Terry Turchie was on with Jesse Waters. And just as we had to remind ourselves of Bob Mueller's illustrious time at FBI before he was the independent counsel, and Jim Comey's record at DOJ before he was the FBI director. You see what we're talking about? You see what Kash Patel and Devin Nunes are talking about? Let's remind ourselves who Merrick Garland is. And I know I'm not talking about the moderate, quote-unquote, Supreme Court nominee. No. I'm talking about Merrick Garland when he was at DOJ. Merrick Garland and the Unabomber case. Merrick Garland when Louis Freeh and Janet Reno had to go over him to greenlight a warrant to search the Unabomber's compound. Take a listen to what Terry Turchi has to say about that case and about his former employer. Well, the United States taxpayer, but the FBI.
And I've never said this publicly, but I'll just tell you right now, because it just sickens me to watch and listen to Merrick Garland. Because Merrick Garland was in charge of the prosecution at DOJ of the Unabomber. And I have to tell you something. He would not recommend to the AG that our search warrant to get into Theodore Kaczynski's cabin be approved. He and his group of attorneys had us working till 2 or 3 in the morning of April 3rd. And finally, the AG, Janet Reno, along with Louis Freeh, they stepped in. They approved the search warrant anyway. Now, that was a case where we had bombs on airplanes. We had threats to blow up airplanes in midair. We had people killed with bombs for 18 years. He wouldn't do anything. He would not recommend to the AG that we get into that cabin on April 3rd. He didn't see the urgency then, and he didn't seem to care about agents being up all night trying to get ready for that. But on this, this is how he handles this. We have what was the last count, 75 perhaps? I'm sure that's real lowball of potential people who are terrorists. They were on the terror watch list. They're in America today somewhere. The FBI has no idea where they are. Christopher Wray could not tell us last week where the Hunter Biden laptop is or if the FBI still has it. But we might have, and I say this very passionately because I also worked counterintelligence for years in the FBI. We may very well have our own highest level of government penetrated by Chinese agents. And the evidence is certainly on the surface. And the patterns are there. I've worked this stuff. I know what it looks like. And many agents feel this way. And yet, we're going to go after record retention violations, which are misdemeanors. It really makes you ill. And it's really made many of us feel very passionate and very sick about what's going on with the Bureau.
So, you know, the particulars of the cases matter, but the bottom line, no aggressive posture when it came to a warrant to search the premises of the suspected Unabomber. And yes, when it comes to going after records retained by a former president while your agency has been in dialogue with his legal representation for the last 6 months. Not political, though. No, of course not. Nick on the Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, Dan, nice to listen to your show. You educate us so well, and that's why you're the man to listen to.
Thank you.
In the morning on this show. I was saying to your screener that the more this is dragging on with all this information about all this dangerous, scary information that Trump took, all the secrets he took, you know, isn't it in reverse more common sense that Trump should have been warned when he's leaving office? Don't take certain boxes marked confidential, not confidential, but like classified or secret or top secret or whatever, all these other initials they threw into these things more and more. That's what they should have done in the beginning, so he would not take certain things. And if he disputes it, then he could have just said, well, I think I should take him. Then they can argue about it at that point.
Yeah. But
this whole thing is obviously just a witch hunt, like Trump says.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Well, right. I mean, it's not like Trump did all the, you know, reviewing of records and determining page by page. You know, I assume this was done by staff, number one, in terms of organizational, the organizational aspect of it, pulling, you know, reams of documents together. What do you want to take? What do you don't want to take? Here's this category. Here's this category. And this is back and forth with his attorneys in conjunction with the National Archives about what can you take and what has to stay and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, again, we don't know any of this yet. And we know some of the reporting on the back and forth and the between Trump world and Garland's DOJ, Biden's DOJ, really. But you know, we don't know all of these particulars. But yeah, it just strains the bounds of credulity to say it lightly that whatever the disagreement is on the specifics, it necessitated that public show of force that you saw a week ago Monday, a week ago today. Right. And so what's the point of that? And as you say, then you have to look at who are the shot callers. And that's why I thought the Patel and Nunez and Terry Turchie's little history of Merrick Garland, particularly useful. Focus on who are the shot callers and what their motivations may be. Let's figure out where whose interests are aligning where. And as Patel said as well, and Nunez part of this too, the Nunez memo, the suggestion that Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, the lovebirds, had polluted the investigation with their bias and corrupted the process and corrupted the agency in part themselves. That was laughed at initially. Well, of course, nobody's laughing now. Nobody was laughing after the text messages came out and after Page left and Strzok was put on leave before he, you know, his friends got him a sinecure at Georgetown. Yeah. Good stuff. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan. How are you today?
Good.
The thing that I want to say is, do the Democrats actually think that Trump would give up top secret information to other countries? After all, how did he work to make this country great again by closing the borders and building a wall and energy independence and building up the military? Do you think he's going to turn around and throw all of this away by giving secrets to a foreign country? I think these people are ridiculous, and I think it's all tied to where they want to discredit him. They want to put it towards January 6th and show a pattern of how reckless he is.
Yeah.
That's what I feel about this. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Rich. Yeah, well, this is, you know, Trump is a threat to our democracy, perhaps the greatest threat. You know, he and his white supremacist friends, that's the party line of the left. And so nothing is beyond the pale. The ends justify the means. We're trying to save our democracy. Don't you understand, Rich? They are. They're trying to save our democracy for us. Mm-hmm. Bob, Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dad. Dan, always enjoy your insight discussions on these topics. I punished myself again watching the Sunday news. It was again Trump, 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 the raid, the raid, the raid. No mention of Hunter, no mention of
Hillary.
Hillary destroying hers. But another thing that I just discovered on the Hill, nobody's mentioning that Marjorie Taylor Greene has like apparently filed impeachment proceedings against Garland. I wonder how far that'll go and if the media will even report on it.
Well, it's not going anywhere. Thanks for the call, Bob. It's been reported, but it's obviously not going anywhere until the balance of power changes in Congress. And so that's a post-November 8th question. Chuck and Delavan.
Hey, how you doing? A little history. Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew and Teddy Roosevelt made the FBI. And just like the Congress is in charge of the Army Corps of Engineers, they're in charge of postal roads and all postal buildings. The Congress has to go. And just like you just stated, nothing's going to happen until you get a complete Republican Congress in there. And this is going to continue to go on. And I wanted to say the other day, I did get on, and I did, when you guys were talking about colleges, I didn't go to college, but I went to visit my friend in at the fraternity, and it was, I felt a sigh. So anyway, I missed you on Friday.
Yeah.
So,
right. Okay, thanks for the call, Chuck.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy still making her way back from Georgia Tech, where she dropped off her eldest to begin his collegiate career. So she'll be back tomorrow. Letter to the editor of the Tribune. You want to understand why it's so difficult to do sensible things in Chicago and Cook County, in Illinois generally, but particularly Chicago and Cook County, as evidenced by, you know, the elected leadership. This letter gives you an insight into the mentality. If anyone knows Ted Z. Manuel, tell him thanks for the example of the mental rot in Chicago. If only Joe Biden controlled the global economy, then his critics would be justified in blaming him for general inflation and gas prices in particular. Alas, he does not. Similarly, Governor J.B. Pritzker has no direct control over the rise and fall of crime. So why do his critics try to hold him responsible for the current upsurge in street crime, which is also seen in other big cities? The same for mayors and police chiefs. Cops arrest criminals after they commit a crime, not before, which would be unconstitutional. Very instructive. Thank you, Ted. We all prefer a crime-free Chicago. So why don't we apply political pressure to build an all-inclusive society with excellent schools and vocational training for all equally? Why do we let certain neighborhoods flounder and fester to where criminality seems the inevitable option among some who see no other options, while 99% of their neighbors are law-abiding? As the social scientists remind us, oh yeah, them, social imbalances produce social disarray. Yes, criminals must be made to pay for their crime, and when caught, most do. Just remember that generational privation produces a predictable blowback among a tiny fraction of those suffering from it, but that tiny fraction can cause an outsized amount of fear, harm, angst, and outrage. It's a signal that society probably made some wrong decisions in the years past as to who gets what, and that it's time to rethink how we restructure and maintain our society to mitigate or eliminate such social disruptions, which are bad for all of us. We all prefer a crime-free Chicago, but we need to apply political pressure to build an all-inclusive society with excellent schools. That's what we're missing. You can't hold the people in charge responsible for society's historical failings. And Ted Z. Manuel, and probably the letters to the editor at the Tribune, thinks he's an intelligent guy. That's what constitutes enlightenment here. This is the leftist cant that you hear everywhere from people who know nothing and prefer fact-free arguments completely rooted in sentiment as opposed to a description of what is happening and what needs to be done in the short term before you get to your grandiose visions of creating heaven on earth, Ted Z. Manuel. Prefer a crime-free Chicago. Why would anybody blame J.B. Pritzker? He has no direct control over the rise and fall of crime. Right? Does anybody? Society does. That's much easier to deal with, just because then you can shoulder shrug and say, I'm a bit of an intellect. You know, I don't look at it the way that the news covers it. Oh, my gosh. You know, the if it bleeds, it leads news. I find that objectionable. We need to think about root causes. You know, the way that Kamala Harris does when it comes to illegal immigration, root causes. Sure. Yeah. Where have we failed this tiny fraction of people who commit an inordinate amount of the violent crime? And when they're caught, most pay for that crime. I don't know if the record actually reflects that. I don't know if the data is there to support that. But I understand that Ted Z. Manuel and so many of his ilk in Chicago think, yeah, people need to hear my opinion. Write a letter to the editor. This is something really unique. I've got a real insight into this condition here in Chicago. Hey, let's all come together. Right, Ted? So come together and bask in my deep thinking. We've let neighborhoods that suffer from generational privation fester. Is that what we've done, Ted? Really? Well, who's done it? Society? It's amazing to me. It never ceases to mystify me how the only people that are not responsible are the people we put in charge to be responsible. Hey, you can't lay this at the footstep of a Lightfoot or Fox or Pritzker. Hey, society. And yet, if you level up to the federal level, just to underscore the point, everything that's wrong with the world is Trump's fault. And I'm sure Ted Z. Manuel would agree. Poison. Mental rot is what it is. Well, I'm operating this little political action committee that's involved in the governor's race, as regular listeners know. And we've been running ads you may have seen online and on TV and heard on the radio, including this station. And I'm going to help Ted try to wrestle with this question. Because I actually think that the only way that you change the culture and you address the mental rot that's occurred between Ted Z. Manuel's ears is to hold the people that you put in charge accountable for what they do or don't do while they're in charge. And so the chief executive of the state would seem to be a good place to start, a fair place to start. And what we've been talking about for many weeks now with renewed intensity because we're up against a January 1 effective date is the so-called Safety Act, which is the mandatory release of violent criminals. This is passed by your Democrat Socialist General Assembly, signed by your Democrat Socialist Governor. And it has real-world implications, as you've heard on this show from county prosecutors, state's attorneys like Jim Glasgow in Wheaton, in Will County, I should say, and Bob Berlin in DuPage County. And they're featured in my ads on radio and TV starting today. Here's the radio.
It will be the summer of joy in Chicago.
Instead, the trio of Pritzker, Lightfoot, and Fox have made this another summer of murder, mayhem, and chaos.
My granddaughter FaceTimed us saying, help me, daddy's shot. And then he shot her.
Thanks to Governor Pritzker, the lawlessness of Chicago will soon be the law statewide. Pritzker's so-called Safety Act makes Illinois a safe haven for violent criminals. That's why 100 of Illinois' 102 county state's attorneys oppose Pritzker's mandatory release of alleged murderers, kidnappers, and arsonists. Prosecutors like Will County State's Attorney Jim Glasgow
it's going to be literally the end of days.
And prosecutors like DuPage County State's Attorney Bob Berlin.
We are going to have violent criminals out on the street.
Stop Chicago violence from coming to your town. Vote no on J.B. Pritzker. Paid for by People Who Play by the Rules Pack.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Again, it's not me saying what's going to happen. It's state's attorneys who are responsible for enforcing the law. These are elected state's attorneys. Ted Z. Emanuel. These people are elected, and they're responsible. So they have some direct control over the rise and fall of crime, just like your civilian politicians do, just like the leadership of your police department does. They have some direct control. Has no direct control over the rise and fall of crime. It's just such an amazing exculpatory statement that is offered by Ted Z. Emanuel, and it is indicative of a civilization, a suicidal civilizational perspective. It really is. Oh, and on the matter of just remember, yes, criminals must be made to pay for their crime, and when caught, most do. Mm-hmm. I know this is just an anecdote, but you know, if you give Ted Z. Emanuel and those who can't think as he can't think, then if you give them the data, they just ignore it. They're not fact-based. They're emotion-based. They over-extrapolate from anecdotes. So I can give you both, but here's an anecdote. Cab driver accused of kidnapping a female passenger in Chicago, then sexually assaulting her, pleaded guilty this week to one count of criminal sexual abuse, causing bodily harm in exchange for a sentence of 2 years probation. Probation. Kidnapping and sexual assault. Probationary offense. Ted Z. Emanuel. Does that sound like being made to pay for a violent crime? The story. June of 2015. Justice DeLay, Justice Denied. The then 23-year-old victim went out with friends to celebrate her passing the CPA exam. At the end of the night, the victim and other women took this guy's cab to one of the women's homes in Ravenswood. The victim told friends she preferred to sleep in her own bed, and she asked the cab driver to drive her home. Fell asleep in the back seat of his cab. Prosecutors say the cab driver drove the victim around for 3 hours around Ravenswood, Lincoln Park, Lakeview. Then he stopped the taxi in the 2600 block of North Polina in Lincoln Park and sexually assaulted the woman while she was asleep in the back seat, and then later dropped her off near her apartment building. The law didn't catch up to him really until 3 years later. And now 4 years after that, he gets 2 years probation. Prosecutors dropped five Class X felony charges in their plea agreement with the cab driver, including multiple counts of aggravated kidnapping and aggravated criminal sexual abuse. Does that sound like a justice system that is doing everything it can, and now we can focus on root causes and generational privation like Ted Z. Emanuel needs us to? Get together for a little roundtable discussion about historic wrongs and the results, the implications, the consequences. Let's focus on that. Let's bloviate and talk through how we got here and where we need to go. I mean, you know, the gestalt of it all, not the immediate emergency needs of the actual residents of the city or the county. We don't have time to deal with people that are just wanting to be safe today. We are going to create an equitable society where everybody's safe always. And certainly we can't do the former while we're thinking about the latter. That's not possible. And the people responsible for affecting the former, well, they're deep thinkers like us. Yeah, I love this part, this thing too. he's no more responsible, J.B. Pritzker, than anybody else who is presiding over big cities that have descended into lawlessness. Right. Gosh, I wonder, again, what ties these big cities together in terms of the people in charge and their approach to public safety. On the other side of the cab driver equation, why don't you ask the widow now of a cab driver in New York, 52-year-old cab driver in New York, who was beaten to death by two individuals who tried to rob him. And he leaves behind two kids, ages 5 and 3. Yeah, right. Happened in other big cities. Gosh, I wonder if we can make a connection between the approach to public safety by politicians in New York City and New York State with those in Chicago and Illinois. Yeah, you really have to put your thinking cap on that one, for that one, don't you, Ted? Ted Z. Manuel. Greg Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan. You know, a friend of mine lives in Park Ridge. Two Fridays ago, he had an attempted home invasion. Guy was beating down his back door, trying to get through, busted the window, then actually broke the other door, but didn't get in. My buddy was sitting about 6 feet away after his wife woke him up and came down with his 9mm and was ready to plug him. But, you know, what's happened since? He's been trying to find out through the police there in the city as to, you know, hey, is this guy still in jail? What's his name? Where does he live? I'm concerned about, you know, his wife and daughter. You know, this guy coming back for retribution or whatever. And, of course, the police can't. We're doing an investigation. We can't tell you anything while this is going on. None of this stuff is ever going to change. And I talked to two other friends of mine who are, you know, loyal union members, you know, Trump haters and all this other stuff, told them about this, the new safety act that's coming into being, and are all like in disbelief over it. I'll tell you something. It's going to be chaos next year. And, you know, nobody cares. These lefties just don't change their mind at all. You have a good one. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Well, right. I mean, that's the question. Yeah, I mean, to your point, not something is going to change. January 1, it's going to change. And this is what you have responsible prosecutors trying to alert the public to what's happening here. And it's fine. I mean, there are going to be some people that until that guy who tried to break into your friend's place in Park Ridge, until that guy or someone like him is at their door, they're not going to think it's real. Or something happens to their 23-year-old daughter after she's when she's out celebrating with friends because she passed her CPA exam. You know, we say these stories like that cab driver thing sticks with me. 23 years old, passed the CPA exam. She's on her way. She's going to have and this traumatic event. I wonder where she is 5 years later. Well, I guess it happened in 2015, 7 years later. I wonder where she is. I wonder how that horrific life-altering event, how that's impacted her. I hope that she's been able to move past it, but of course we know many people can't. But it's just another statistic. It's just another story of violent crime du jour. And then Ted Z. Manuel and those lefties that Greg and Jefferson Park are talking about. Yeah, we have to look at, you know, generational issues and are we spending enough per pupil at CPS and so on and so forth? I wish people would have the gumption to call out the inhumanity of those around them when they see it, which is why I seized upon Ted Z. Manuel's letter to the editor, because he's a barbarian. Really. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Clean out the Augean stables.
Okay, Hercules.
That is what we have to have in terms of the politicians in the Republican Party who are running. And, you know, I struggled with who to vote for Attorney General, DeVore or Shostakis, and I'm glad I ultimately chose DeVore because I love the way he has been campaigning the last month and a half. He seems like he's, you know, going to do what he needs to do if he gets elected, to reform this government and to, you know, attack crime and the gangsterism in our government. I hope Mr. Bailey does that. I don't have that sense out of his campaign yet. I know it's early, and I know it's after Labor Day is when it really counts, but he needs to make sure that he has that same energy and that this corruption and the gangsterism in our government has to be the main theme, in my opinion, because that's a universal value that I think almost all people would vote for, that type of program.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate that. Just to going back to Ted's email, it's just one more point in this letter. I know maybe it doesn't get a rise out of you the way it did me, but I'm just so sick of this self-regarding pablum from people like this guy. It's so destructive to the city and the state. Why don't we apply political pressure? This is his words. Why don't we apply political pressure to build an all-inclusive society with excellent schools and stuff? Yeah. And then you see this story over the weekend. The perfect Chicago story. Ted's Emanuel should get a job writing columns at the AFL-CIO NPR Times. CPS enrollment could drop by 15,000 students, but that could benefit, the district researchers say. You know, there's nothing that benefits a school system like losing students. I mean, things are really looking up over at CPS. Everyone's leaving. We're doing such a great job. Why would it benefit CPS? Well, you have to understand the premises from where these people start. Why do you think? CPS's main revenue source is state and local property tax are relatively stable and don't decline significantly when enrollment drops. With fewer students, CPS actually has more money to spend on each child. Hooray! The money will still be there. You know, instead of 29 grand per kid, maybe we kick it up to 31. And so then maybe somebody at the Harper High School will learn how to read. That's what you're dealing with in Chicago.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy off today, making her way back from dropping her kid off at college, Georgia Tech. He's a yellow jacket, so she'll be back tomorrow. You know how compelling the case that Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice, the FBI, has made with respect to this raid on Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and everything that's ensued over the last week? You know how strong the evidence is that this was necessary? That this is a infraction, a potential infraction, alleged infraction that jeopardizes our democracy. This is how serious it is. This is the kind of commentary you get from the D.C. press corps on the merits of the legal matter here. ABC chief investigative reporter Josh Margolin had this to say.
To a judge this week. That's why I personally don't think, based on my knowing this attorney general and our covering of him, that he's somebody who would have allowed this to happen in a rash way, because he had to know that as soon as this happened, it would supercharge a supercharged environment. And in fact, that's what we saw. As soon as President Trump put out confirmation on Monday that the raid had been done and was underway, we immediately started seeing factions on the far right, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, militia organizers, calling for violence, as they always have done, against Jews. The attorney general is Jewish.
Merrick Garland is the subject of Trump-supporting white supremacist anti-Semites who are attacking him, you know, because he's Jewish. To criticize Merrick Garland is to throw in with those white supremacist insurrectionists. The story doesn't end. does it? And just as we talked about a little bit earlier in the program, why would the story end? The same people are in similar positions of authority, perhaps more important positions of authority than they were back during the first two terms of the Joe Obama years. They're still around. They're still prosecuting their same claims, and that relates not just to their time with President Obama in his administration, not just to their time here, but also to their time working on Hillary Clinton's campaign and losing to Donald Trump. So there's literally, arguably, and you'll hear from Kash Patel, a 15-year uninterrupted reign of these same individuals on the left. Lisa Monaco, number two at Justice. Susan Rice, domestic policy advisor now to Biden. Jake Sullivan, NSA.
Basically, the same corrupt FBI government gangsters, the same agents that were involved in Russiagate, the same counterintelligence agents that were involved in making the bad false call on Hunter Biden's laptop, or you're going to see are the same counterintelligence agents that helped raid or assist in the raid to President Trump's home.
Devin Nunes, former House Intel chair, takes it back further than that.
I think this goes back to the IRS scandal where they targeted conservatives. I think it goes back to Fast and Furious during the Obama administration, where they ran guns and tried to set people up. You remember? And then innocent Americans ended up getting killed. It goes back to Benghazi. They got away with that. And then you have to remember, it was late 2015 or 16 that we get to the plan where the Clinton campaign, working with dirty cops at DOJ and FBI and the media, I must say, where they set up to spy on the Trump campaign and ultimately Republicans and frame an innocent man that then led to what? So that was the Russia hoax that then led to the Mueller witch hunt. So all of this stuff is intertwined, and then you just fast forward, you know, Cash mentioned, you know, the Whitmer case and Jan 6 and whether or not federal agents were involved in that. So you just stair step, and then ultimately this leads to what? This leads to something never done in American history before. You had a president's home ransacked by the same goons that were involved in all of this. And I would say that you know, a lot of people have criticized, you know, the FBI and the DOJ, and I think rightfully so, but someone are making these calls. And I would say that the people that have been involved in all those scandals that I just listed are the very same people that are now in charge of the DOJ and are at the White House.
For more on this, please be joined by Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney and contributing editor at National Review, also the author of Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Dan, it's my pleasure.
So you may not agree with some of the characterizations you heard from Kash Patel and Devin Nunes, but what about this idea that there is you know, you're looking at some of the same people who've been in various positions in DOJ and FBI and gone back and forth. Merrick Garland was a former prosecutor at FBI. Actually, Terry Turchi, the former deputy assistant director of the FBI, made the point Merrick Garland wouldn't sign off on a warrant for the Unabomber's compound when he was a prosecutor at DOJ, but he was happy to greenlight this raid on President Trump's compound over a potential infraction regarding the maintenance of documents. What about this idea that it is a, well, to lack of a better word, a cabal that's existed within the halls of power for the last 15 years?
Yeah, I think it's a big problem. I don't disagree with Cash or Devin about, you know, the systematic nature of this and how long it goes back. And my take on this is a little different from theirs, I think, because I'm willing to acknowledge the wrongdoing on our side. What bothers me is the two tiers of justice. So,
yeah,
you know, I went back this morning looking at some of the stuff I wrote during the Hillary Clinton emails escapade, and I always thought, Dan, that you know, once they decided not to prosecute her on classified information, which they had to distort the statute in order to not do, they just basically acted like there was nothing else at issue, when I kept trying to argue that she had converted to her own use and destroyed thousands of government records, which, you know, her emails with respect to State Department work clearly were, and that I said she should have been prosecuted under the Federal Embezzlement Act, which makes it a crime to convert to your own use and destroy government property. Crickets. No one even, you know,
right.
That never even got into the discussion. So, you know, what they're talking about with Trump now, with great indignation, is what they turned a blind eye to with Hillary seemingly just 5 minutes ago. So,
The other thing, though, too, about this, I mean, I think that is a salient point you're making. But the other thing about this is, if this is so urgent, and this is the Wall Street Journal opines, this is so urgent, and the document's so sensitive relating to a nuclear program and so forth. Why did it take 18 months?
I agree. I couldn't agree with you more on that. I think what happened here is, you can't look at this in a vacuum. They got pressure in June. The left, I think it was beginning with Rachel Maddow, went crazy over this idea that Garland had reaffirmed Bill Barr's guidance, which I think most people would have thought was common sense, Dan, that if you're going to investigate a presidential candidate, the attorney general needs to sign off on that.
Yeah.
And that's like saying you should put your socks on before your shoes, right? I mean, who wouldn't have thought that was the case? But when Garland said what Barr's guidance was good guidance and he intended to follow it, the left took that as a signal that he wasn't serious enough about nailing Trump on January 6th. So everybody keeps saying, what happened? What's the difference? What happened in June or what's happened since June that made all this necessary? Well, at the end of June, they did search warrants on Eastman and Jeffrey Clark, the two lawyers who were involved in the January 6th stuff. They've issued grand jury subpoenas to Pence's aides. They've issued grand jury subpoenas to two of the lawyers at Trump's White House counsel's office. And the day after Mar-a-Lago, they went up to a member of Congress, Scott Perry,
on the street when
he was on vacation with his family in Pennsylvania, and did a search warrant on him and took his phone. So they're obviously ratcheting up their investigation of January 6th. I think I've written about this. I think it's very clear that they're trying to make a case that Trump conspired to defraud the United States and to obstruct the congressional count. All the people who I just described are involved in that in the sense of either being witnesses or participants as far as this theory is concerned. And if you agree with my analysis and the timeline, I don't accept it. When they tell me that the raid on Mar-a-Lago had nothing to do with the guy who is the main guy they're trying to nail on January 6th,
right,
when it happens in the middle of everything they're doing on January 6th, I'm not buying it.
Well, right,
I'm not saying they didn't have, you know, he had classified information, fine. He had presidential records he shouldn't have had, fine. But I think what triggered this is January 6th. I don't think it's that other stuff.
But if that theory is correct, and it certainly seems more likely than not to me, then they committed yet another fraud on another court in misrepresenting the purpose of the raid.
Well, not really as a matter of law. I mean, what you need for a search warrant is you have to have evidence of a crime and probable cause evidence of the crime will be found in the place that you want to search. So if they had probable cause that he was retaining classified information, and I know, by the way, I get there's a proof problem with that because he may have declassified the documents. I get that's the kind of a thing that would be a defense if they ever charged him. But if they had probable cause on the classified information and probable cause that it was in Mar-a-Lago, and it looks like they had slammed on probable cause because they've been, you know, discussing it with him, then they had enough to get in there.
But they
withheld their real purpose.
Yes, what I'm saying is that when I say fraud, I don't mean in a criminal sense.
I'm with you. I'm telling you because this happened to me last week. I used the word pretextual, and I got all kinds of blowback that I was saying it was a fraud on the court. So I'm a little sensitive to that. But well, I'm not saying they committed fraud on the court, but I am saying
they acted in bad faith.
Their closet agenda is more important to them than the reason they told the court they needed to do the search.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, it just continues. I mean, if they care about the American people trusting them, at minimum, you're operating in bad faith if what your theory is correct, and I suspect it is. And so it just, you know, it fuels the abolish the FBI and impeach Merrick Garland. I mean, I don't know who they think they're fooling other than their fellow travelers.
You're right, but, you know, they're making the country more – I'm going to say the same thing I said when they abused FISA. You know, the reason we have FISA is that there really are terrible people in the world who want to do harm to Americans. And when the government abuses the authority that we actually need to protect the country, what it does is it undermines the political support for maintaining those authorities because you think the government can't be trusted with it. And we can take away the authorities because we have untrustworthy people wielding them. But the country's going to be less safe. I mean, we actually need something like the FBI. It doesn't have to be the FBI.
No, I know.
It's got to be something like the FBI. And I've argued, Dan, that they should take away their, you know, you want to get their attention, take away their national security mission. Take away the foreign counterintelligence mission. Let them go back to being a federal police force, which they were actually good at.
Yeah, and then maybe they'd be focused on, for example, the 5 or 6 dozen people on the terrorist watch list who've come in through our southern border, and we don't know where they are, for example, right?
You want them doing good. Do cops and robbers. They were good at that. I don't think the iSpy stuff is – they're not good at it.
Yeah. One thing just about the documents themselves. So the issues raised about attorney-client privilege as well as executive privilege with respect to whatever it was the FBI seized, is that potentially an argument that the Trump lawyers can make to return those documents to undermine any essential claim by the federal government that he mishandled classified information?
No, I don't think. I think, you know, Trump is conflating two different things. The property should not have been at Mar-a-Lago. It's perfectly appropriate for us to be saying that they shouldn't have used criminal law methods to get it back. They shouldn't have done an unprecedented search warrant to get the property back. But that stuff is the property of the United States. It's not the personal property of Donald Trump. And there's a lot of, you know, that warrant allows you to take every single document that was generated for the 4 years of the Trump administration. It's not just about classified information. And in part, that's because they've been arguing with him for 2 years about the stuff he's got down there, not just the classified information. They want that stuff back because it's covered under the Presidential Records Act. So the fact that he might have attorney-client privilege and executive privilege would be relevant if there was some issue that came up in an investigation where the Justice Department wanted access to this information and Trump wanted to stop them from getting access, just like he asserted executive privilege to try to stop the January 6th committee from getting stuff that was in the National Archives. But the thing is, the property belongs to the United States. So even if he has executive privilege or attorney-client privilege, that doesn't mean he gets to get it back at Mar-a-Lago. That limits what the Justice Department can do with it.
Yes, maybe. Right, exactly. Right.
But it doesn't mean he gets it back.
Right.
He shouldn't have had it in the first place.
The other matter that was essentially documented in the search warrant the portion of the search warrant made public, a reference to the Espionage Act and the idea that the criminal investigation potentially implicates the Espionage Act in whatever Trump may or may not have done. How do you react to that?
Well, I think they're kind of stuck with the position they took on Hillary Clinton, which, by the way, I thought was a preposterous distortion of the statute, but it's their distortion, right? So the Obama-Biden Justice Department, in connection with Clinton, said that you couldn't use the Espionage Act to prosecute unless you could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person actually intended to harm the United States. Now, the statute doesn't say that, but that's what they said with Hillary. There's no proof that Trump was trying to harm the United States. And the other thing that Comey and the rest of them said about that was that, you know, when we pointed out to them that their reading of the statute was preposterous, they pivoted to the position that, well, we never prosecute anybody on this, so it would be an unconstitutional selective prosecution if we singled her out. So, you know, I think what's good for the goose, right? What's good for the gander? I don't know. What's good for somebody?
Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney, contributing to National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Thanks as always, Andy. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dan.
He joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy off today. She's still making her way back from dropping her son off at Georgia Tech, so she'll be back tomorrow. I thought this was an interesting piece over at RealClearPolitics.com. Stuart Scheller, a 17-year veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, combat deployments in Iraq, Afghanistan, Beirut. America needs leaders with fresh eyes. Critical of the military leadership, but also at present, but also with you know, a succinct but historical review of U.S. military since Woodrow Wilson. He writes that military service over the last two decades can do a lot to prepare someone for action in the public arena, but former service members must break free of the servile mindset pervading the U.S. military if they're to rise to the leadership challenge facing America. To advance today's military, asking questions, calling out problems, or being anything other than a yes man is frowned upon, even outright punished. Loyalty to the system, quote unquote, is valued above warfighting skill, leadership, and critical thinking. And yet look at the record of this system since World War II. Failure to accomplish political objectives in Vietnam, Beirut, Kosovo, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. Even worse, the government has depleted economic, diplomatic, and information resources in pursuit of what turned out to be failed objectives. Fear of blame shifting leads most active duty military members to remain silently and singularly focused on their compartmentalized jobs. Inept leadership across the entire military leads to confusion about its role in foreign policy, or frankly, domestic social engineering. My parenthetical remark. He writes that since Wilson's 14-point speech in 1918, America has served as the international system's leader, but since Vietnam, American leaders have recklessly chased problems across the world without a long-term strategy for increasing national power. America cannot afford another out-of-touch generation of senior military and civilian leaders, but here we are. As Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin was advancing the idea the greatest threat facing his department was COVID-19. Russia was staging forces on the border of Ukraine. America was preparing to exit the longest war in American history, and the Defense Department was decaying internally from procurement, promotion, and education problems. Due to misplaced priorities, the Afghanistan evacuation that we're remembering today, a year later, failed, and the global order deteriorated. And I would add, I think Mr. Scheller would agree that it's made the world order deteriorated, also more precarious, particularly with our number one enemy of the state. That would be the Chinese communists vis-a-vis Taiwan. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine Ann Shelby Colm Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting, Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, what about this review from Stuart Scheller about what we've done and failed to do and what we need? And if he's right, where's it going to come from? Because the military is having a recruiting problem not dissimilar from big city police forces.
Yeah. So first of all, I come at this not just as a 25-year military veteran who lived through a lot of the times you just talked about.
Yeah.
but also as a trained military historian who's written on a lot of times that he's talked about. And so there's a thing called cherry picking, which is, you know, you pick the evidence you like and ignore the evidence that doesn't fit your thesis. And I mean, that's part of the problem with this article. I mean, he ripped off a litany of military failures. He also kind of neglected some major successes, including winning the Cold War, which you better believe that the U.S. military played an incredibly important part in helping to win the Cold War and convincing the Russians they just couldn't compete anymore. Not to mention the Reagan years, which was arguably some of the most brilliant use of the military instrument and some of the best integration between military and political leaders that we've seen in modern times. And not to mention the Trump administration, which actually, you know, just hair on fire, orange glow and tweeting aside, actually, and which had its own issues with civil military relations. But so having said all that, having seen the good and the bad of military, which, by the way, is normal, right? The militaries are not like some eternal machine that you turn on and they just grind wonderfully forever. If they are well led, well supported, and well used, they do magnificently. If they're not, they're just like, there's some reasons why some years the Pittsburgh Steelers win the Super Bowl and some years they don't break 500. Everything has everything to do with resourcing and leadership. So here's why I agree with them. Certainly in the Obama years, in which Obama came in and said we need to take a peace dividend, even though there was no peace, with no serious plan for how to engage in the world, diluting the military resources and promoting generations of general officers who were compliant, and sending a very strong message that if you wanted to get by in this Pentagon, you need to be compliant with them, filling the ranks of the civil servants in the Pentagon with people who are political operatives. And we've seen that come back with a force under Biden. Yeah, I do think we have serious issues. You know, and in civil military relations and in the military's appropriate role in dealing with civilians. And I think we have a generation of senior military leaders that are failing us. And I think we have a Pentagon, which is the most politicized it's ever been since we first built the building. And I do agree that these are serious problems. And if we don't get our military back to the basics, then we're messed up. And here's where I disagree with him. You know, he said that, you know, the people that just, you know, follow the rules aren't interested in war fighting. You know, those things all go in common. And the difference is this. What makes for a good military contribution is selfless service, that you're there for only one purpose, to serve the nation's interests. And it doesn't mean you're blind to politics, because some of the most successful military officers in our entire history were people who actually understood that the military, just like everybody else in society, has to survive in a political environment. And what they managed to do is understand that their commitment was to selfless service, to pilot the institution through that, so it's best serving the nation. So people like George Marshall and Dwight Eisenhower and General Abrams and others, you know, they did this with skill and loyalty and effectiveness. And we've had civilians do that as well, like Melvin Laird when he was Secretary of Defense and some others. But we are poorly led. And when you're poorly led and poorly resourced, you get what you get.
That's a good response. Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. I mean, I sort of I think about it in the context almost of the church, or just a metaphor, not, you know.
I think it's exactly the same.
So you have bad leadership, but you know, for example, and you know, good people suffer within the church because of the poor leadership and poor decisions and so on and so forth, because, you know, it's still an organization run by earthly men. And so is the military. And but that doesn't eliminate the institution or the need to stay within the confines and navigate until you can help be a part of bringing about better leadership.
Here's the difference. In the old days, it was, okay, you get some bad leaders in there. The institution is your rock upon which you stand. And when the leaders go, the institution goes back to being what it should be. This is, for example, what happened after Vietnam. what we have today are political leaders in the Obama and Biden administration who are intent on changing the institutions.
Yeah.
So they are unrecognizable. And when I watch it, like at my alma mater at West Point, people being taught critical race theory, and not as something to understand. I studied the Communist Manifesto at West Point as a cadet and as a professor because we were trying to understand what it was. But I wasn't being taught that the Communist Manifesto was kind of a cool idea.
Yeah.
Critical race theory is, to me, of all the things that we're doing, the most destructive. Because it,
certainly in the military. Yeah.
Because in the military, you look at a person and you see a uniform, not a man, not a woman, not a young, you see a uniform and a person that you expect to serve honorably and with competence and who you owe equal, you know, support and commitment to. And so you try to erase everything that's behind that uniform. I spent 25 years trying to explain to people that that when they put the uniform on, we are all equal and we are all committed and we are all responsible. And that was it. And that is the exact opposite of what critical race theory teaches you.
I wanted to get to some of our the enemies of the state, our state, that is. Beginning with China, there's an interesting piece out on Friday, reading from the Military Times about these war games that have been conducted, gaming out what the potential impacts would be if the U.S., if China sought to invade Taiwan and the U.S. intervened to support Taiwan in some form or fashion, that we've intervened to support Ukraine. And, you know, the results are, at minimum, disastrous economically and potentially problematic in terms of the loss of human life on top of it, particularly American service persons. So I just wanted to get your take on that sort of war gaming that's done and how much weight we should put on that.
Well, these things are of varying quality because a lot of it goes on the assumptions that you put in on the front end, including, you know, the assumptions you make about what the other side's going to do and what you know about their capabilities. Ironically, so I'm at the Heritage Foundation. We're a think tank. We actually just did a Taiwan war game like last week, and we did one last year. I tell you one thing, no matter who does them, they're bloody. And, mm-hmm. and the impact they have on both the Chinese, even more on the Chinese economy than the U.S. economy is really, really kind of shocking. Look, I will say this. There's no question, I don't think in anybody's mind that really does this stuff, that thinks that Taiwan is an easy one-day job for China and that there's a surgical, clean, effortless way to do this. If the U.S. weighs in and other regional allies weigh in, it gets even more problematic. I also think what we saw in Ukraine is when nuclear powers face off against each other, either they don't escalate to nuclear war because it's just too freaking dangerous. And so that either means that you're fighting a war through surrogates, like, you know, supplying Taiwan, we supply the Ukraine, or if the forces do get directly involved, they both have to constrain their behavior, which means you have to fight it. In the end, you wind up fighting it out on the ground, which can be really, really tough.
I wanted to get to the attack on Salman Rushdie as well in New York on Friday. Fortunately, he appears to be doing better. It looks like he's going to survive. That's good. The person who was arrested and charged with attempting to murder Salman Rushdie reportedly had been in contact with members of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, although, of course, the Western papers are quick to report there's no evidence that Iranian officials were involved in the orchestration or execution of the attack, as if they need to be. You know, the fatwa is issued, the fatwa stands. What was your reaction to the attack on Rushdie? I mean, obviously, not the attack itself. I know what your reaction is. It was a terrible thing. You're glad he's alive. But in terms of this ongoing effort by this administration to get a nuclear deal with Iran.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with a really clever metaphor. And I almost count. It's like, when does this end? You know, it's like, when does this end? I mean, what is intolerable for this administration? I mean, what egregious act that the Iranians actually have to commit for the United States just to say, okay, this is never going to work. I mean, forget all the cheating, forget all the surrogate wars, all the things they do on go. They literally are paying people to track down and kill former U.S. officials, which to me, and that's not, that's reported by the U.S. government. That's not, you know, hey, I was talking to some guy in the RGC. There are people in Iran which are paying to track down and kill American former government officials. And then this comes on top of that. And they're still, and they still want to make excuses to say somehow the Iran deal is going to do something. Even as the technical data shows that an Iran deal cannot keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. I mean, what possible logic on the planet Earth could there still be in pursuing a deal which is useless, which we know will only empower and engage Iran and give them more money and make them more powerful? How could this possibly be? I mean, you know, what was that really, you know, that really bad movie and that people, you know, were tweeting about it, so they re-released it and nobody went to see it again either. I mean, what do we have to tell these guys before they get it?
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Annie, join us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy off today, coming back from dropping her son off at college. She'll be back tomorrow. We'll talk about the skinny Green New Deal, the IRS expansion and growth reduction legislation that was, as expected, passed by the House on Friday, sent to the president's desk for signing, which is going to happen. We'll talk a bit about that with John Tammany at the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour, but I want to talk about it now, too, with you. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Some remarkable commentary from Flax for the White House over the weekend. First, Pramila Jayapal, she's a socialist from Wisconsin, excuse me, from Washington State, that is, Washington State. And she's also the leader of the avowed socialist Spice Girls, and that would include men who identify as P-hat socialists like Sean Kasten. Yeah, Progressive Caucus leader, Pramila Jayapal from Washington State. She had this to say about the inflation reduction piece of the Inflation Reduction Act.
It is ultimately going to lead to a reduction in overall inflation, but most importantly, to the budget that people have every single day. Inflation is like a theoretical word that economists use, but what families feel every day is the up or down of costs.
Whew. Inflation is a theoretical word economists use. Right, it's a word economists use. It's not theoretical. It's a word that economists use to describe something that's happening in the real world in which Pramila Jayapal doesn't live. That's definitely an instant classic. Inflation is just a theoretical word economists use. That is part of your leadership in the United States House of Representatives. Your presidential spokesbeing, the quadruple threat KJP, Karine Jean-Pierre, made the fateful decision to go on this week with Jonathan Carl, where she had to try to explain the inflation reduction piece of the Inflation Reduction Act. And here was her attempts. See who did a better job, her, KJP, or Pramila Jayapal.
But let me ask you, it's called the Inflation Reduction Act. But the Congressional Budget Act Office, which is nonpartisan, said that there would be a negligible impact on inflation this year and barely impact inflation at all next year. I mean, isn't it almost Orwellian? How can you call it Inflation Reduction Act when the nonpartisan experts say it's not going to?
So I appreciate that. I appreciate the question. We've actually addressed this, the CBO. It was the top line number. There's more in there that shows that it will have the money from. Remember how we're doing this, too. It's making sure that billionaires in corporate America are paying their fair share, making sure that that the tax code is a little bit more fair. And so when you do that, when you put it in its totality, you will see that it will bring down, lower the deficit, which will help fight inflation.
If anybody can unpack that, please give me a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. This is basically what you see done all the time, just some people are more skilled at doing it than others. You basically just string these buzz phrases together. How will it actually reduce inflation? Well, you know, if you look at holistically long term, and we've got budget deficit and reduction, and then the wealthy are going to pay their fair share. And, you know, we're very concerned about prices coming down, and this is intended to bring prices down for the American people. And so on. This is good work. We got more work to do because there's always more work to do, but we're doing that work every single day. Wow. I mean, it's just, it's not surprising, because if you pay attention, you realize that most of the people that have been elected to represent your interests at the federal, the state, at the local level, just are not particularly talented. They are just not particularly intelligent. They just do not know what they're talking about, other than to repeat something that somebody else told them, because they understand the limitations of the person they're dealing with. So you have some spinster who tells KJP, just say these words. Doesn't matter what order. Just go on, just say these phrases every time you're asked about this legislation. And so that's what she did. Well, good for her. By the way, the tax code and the rich paying their fair share and all that. Does that rhetoric ever get tired? Does it ever become nails on a chalkboard? Does it ever lose its meaning? According to the Congressional Budget Office, among the lies that are being told about this legislation, the idea that only people making more than $400,000 will face the daunting encounter with a IRS audit. IRS audits will generate $20 billion, the CBO projects, from those making under $400,000. $20 billion is a lot. You know why? Because according to official tax gap estimates, 78% to 90% of underreported tax dollars come from families making less than $200,000. And a mere 4% from those making $500,000 or more. Right. The people that don't necessarily have a team of accountants making sure that they take advantage of everything the tax code allows, but also not so much that they're going to red flag themselves for an audit. Yeah. Whereas those making a little bit less, doing it themselves, or... And this is the same story every time the issue of class envy politics is raised. They will always, I'm talking about the tax eaters, they will always come for you, middle income family, always without exception, because that's where the money is. That's where the majority of the money is held. Yes, there's a lot of money held in a few hands, but the majority is where the plurality of the population falls, basically between 50 and 150. So if you think you're exempt because some politician told you they're only interested in the billionaire class, that's a true telltale sign that you're dealing with a professional liar. Okay. Also, I'll take a couple calls. I want to make one more point on this. Kevin in Austin, Texas, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Whenever referring, I think you've been doing it, referring to the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, it should be referred to the IRS Expansion Act or the Government Expansion Act. And anybody who's a plumber, a painter, somebody driving a tunneling van this morning, somebody who's in real estate, somebody who has a small insurance agency, they're all the ones who are going to be less productive because they're going to have to put more time into this than the growing their business. And it doesn't matter what state you go to. So people advocating for separation, you know, go to the red states and blue states, it doesn't matter. So they're growing the government to make life more miserable for people in the middle class. So, you know, definitely it's the IRS Expansion Act.
And growth reduction. That's right. Thanks for the call, Kevin, because when you tax investment, you get less of it, you get less growth. But somehow they still think that the supply chains are going to fix themselves and people who are intent on producing will produce, and the combination of that plus the Fed's mystics, that this will all work out. Although Jamie Dimon and others disagree. Jamie Dimon on an investor call: the numbers are so distorted when you have this fiscal and monetary stimulus. Have you seen a recession where unemployment is going down? Inflation is around 8%. I don't see it will dissipate that quickly. I think the Fed had 4% by the end of the year. I think that's highly unlikely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I talked to somebody else over the weekend who is a highly successful private equity guy and has a trading firm and so forth. It's the same thing. It's people who know, and he had experience trying to unwind things back in 08, high level experience. Like he says the same thing. I don't see inflation because of this, you know, zero month over month from June to July. I don't see inflation as inexorably going down. I think we're still very much in the woods with respect to inflation, which is, of course, a wealth killer. And so, you know, those prices that you middle income families are feeling at the grocery store and at the pump, don't be so sure that we're moving to a place where it will, you know, decrease at a 45 degree angle based on, well, certainly not based on this legislation, the skinny Green New Deal. This is going to have negligible impact, short term at least, and long term it will be negative for the moral hazards that have been created. And of course, the adding to the ranks of the IRS, that's not a productive, that's not something that you think that's a way to spur economic growth, is expand the IRS's foot soldiers. But we're not anywhere near where most people who have real expertise in that world suggest that we can think about putting inflation in our rearview mirror. Lee in Hammond, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hi, Dan. You know, Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, their Great Reset, people that feel that people need to be controlled like cattle, that's all these Democrats are doing, is parroting exactly what they've been told by them. It's like you say, they don't have the brain power to actually understand what they're promoting. But once their Valhalla is in place, we're all going to be treated like a bunch of animals in a zoo, which is about what the respect that these people have for us. And unfortunately, a lot of these Democrats are so dense they can't even understand that.
Thanks for the call, Lee. Inflation is just a theoretical word economists use. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, your progressive caucus leader. Remember that. Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dad. What if these governments going to start spending their fair share instead of blaming billionaires? But where I'm sitting, I'd rather trust a billionaire with my investment money because they have a track record of making money, unlike the government, which has a track record of throwing the money away on programs that are riddled with fraud.
Thanks for the call, Mark.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, but no Amy today. She's still traveling back from Atlanta after dropping her eldest off to start his collegiate career at Georgia Tech, so she'll be back tomorrow. You know how inflation is just a theoretical word that economists use? We learned that from Pramila Jayapal, just mentioning last hour. So it's critical race theory. Critical race theory is just an esoteric concept that's discussed mainly in law schools. But I got to say, I do appreciate its implementation in cases like with the Minneapolis Public School teacher contract. Doing something innovative in Minneapolis. I don't know if you've heard. The teacher's contract stipulates that white teachers will be laid off or reassigned before educators of color in the event that the Minneapolis public schools need to reduce staff. That sound about right to you? Fans of identitarianism? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's sort of fun to see. I mean, I'm sure not all Minneapolis teachers feel this way, but it is sort of fun, generally speaking, given what we know about teachers' unions and the majority of their membership based on all sorts of behavioral evidence, like voting and signage during protests and whatnot. Wonderful to see that those who toe the party line about things like CRT or social emotional learning being these esoteric concepts that mainly the province of law schools, or they're just figments of the right-wing hate machine and they don't really exist. This is just all fodder for those cultural warriors on the right. What about this? Alpha News reporting right here on the contract. Exemption from layoff for designated program staff. Teachers who are members of populations underrepresented among licensed teachers in the district. Alumni of historically black colleges and universities, tribal colleges and universities, and or Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities programs. Non-white people can be protected from layoffs because of their skin color. And it's nice to see that it's not esoteric anymore. It's not an abstraction. It's concrete. And they modify, or they memorialize it in the teacher contract. Isn't that great? I'd like to see it and all the teachers' union contracts, wouldn't you? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What a better lesson in CRT for the kids than to have the teachers and the teachers' unions, their union representatives, lead the way, being the change they wish to see. What do you think, honky teachers? Layoffs shouldn't be based on seniority anymore, which is the normal protocol with these collective bargaining agreements, as most everybody knows. Make it race-based. Correct historic wrongs. Reparations and such. Take up the fight against white privilege among those honky teachers. Yeah? I mentioned social-emotional learning because, you know, now that the kids are preparing to go back to class and the COVID restrictions in most places are all but gone, I guess in Philadelphia is an exception. The first 10 days of the year, they're requiring mask wearing for some sort of performative reason. You know, they'll have some 10 to 11th-day celebration of conquering COVID or something. Social-emotional learning, we've talked about it before. This is another Trojan horse. Good piece by Daniel Buck, actually at National Review, which I don't get to say very much, good piece at National Review anymore. But this is one. Social-emotional learning. This is something, again, that started somewhat innocently enough, just frankly like CRT did. There's, you know, it's no problem, as we were talking about with Jim Carafano, you know, he studied the Communist Manifesto, right? There's no problem being exposed to theories like critical race theory. The problem is when it's a manual, it's a how-to, turned into a how-to manual of how we're going to organize society, doing things like firing white teachers before teachers of color just because. Not based on behavior, not based on seniority, not based on performance, just based on we have to do a RIF, we have to do a reduction in force, the honkies go first because they're privileged. Oppressor and oppressed. That's the curriculum in the classroom. Why wouldn't it be applied in the real world? SEL, social emotional learning. You know, I wonder if this will start to get higher or start to get more profile as CRT has been properly pilloried. And I think more people recognize this and are prepared to combat this because, you know, most people of goodwill don't believe in segregation, for example, that CRT is driving, that black kids can only be taught by black teachers and with their fellow black students and white kids, white teachers. And that, I mean, this is the stuff. Everything's oppressor and oppressed, as I just mentioned. We've talked about this ad nauseum. We haven't perhaps spent as much time on social emotional learning as we should because it started out, as Daniel Buck recounts, you know, it was dubious in terms of any effectiveness, but it was also rather benign. It hadn't been hyper-politicized. So it was just about, oh, you know, think about your kid's social and emotional development in addition to their intellectual development. You have to look at the whole kid. Oh, okay, well, who would disagree with that? Well, it's the implementation. That's always the issue. He writes, it was an educational fad, a sort of secular character education, but it's since become another means of injecting progressive politics into the classroom. And as always, it's conservatives' fault for noticing. The foremost organization advancing social-emotional learning, again, look out for them, the Collaborative for Academic Social and Emotional Learning, and frankly, any organization that begins with collaborative should get your spidey senses tingling. CASEL is the acronym. The group recently made an organizational shift moving toward transformation or transformative SEL. Not SEL anymore, transformative SEL. Here we go. The transformative SEL, social emotional learning, transforming inequitable settings and systems and promoting justice-oriented civic engagement. Ultimately, transformative SEL, this is their writing on the topic. Ultimately, transformative SEL is concerned with not just the analysis of disparate experiences of social and emotional well-being, but with encouraging you to engage in collective projects and activities that aim to contribute to community well-being and justice. In short, go do politics. Go do left-wing politics. Research issues and advocate for change. Right. You think it's to promote school choice? No, I don't think so. Rick Hess, the director of education policy studies at AEI, notes that in practice, SEL is usually a justification for doing away with traditional grading, eliminating advanced math, subjecting students and staff to privilege walks, or teaching first graders about gender identity. In other words, SEL becomes a feel-good term that applies a stamp of approval to a host of progressive wish list items. That's what's actually happening. And that's actually the point in this this piece, conservatives are right to be skeptical of SEL that Daniel Buck wrote for National Review. So we see this as you have tens of thousands of parents around the country, actually just in Chicago, pulling their kids from these government schools and going somewhere else. Maybe they're going to another government school and they just don't want to live in a shooting gallery like Chicago, or maybe they're starting to get wise to this, but regardless, you know, this fight will pick up in earnest as your kids go back to school. I know the relief of not having to deal with COVID, at least in the near term, based on the relaxation of CDC guidance, which is treated as gospel by government school educrats. But this other stuff, no, that is ever present. Ever present. And frankly, in addition to issues of economic security and physical security, the education your kids are getting in these schools is on the ballot on November 8th, too.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
So we've spent a lot of time this morning talking about the raid, the release of the property receipt and search warrant on Friday, and of course the standards that have been established by, for example, former FBI Director Jim Comey, and with respect to Hillary's emails, as compared to what this FBI director, this attorney general, appeared to be intent on doing with respect to President Trump and his possession of classified documents. Well, there's a fun little remix that some innovative chap put together online, the Comey Hillary remix. Just a fun way to remember how it was handled when it was Hillary versus how it's being handled today.
Good morning. I'm here to give you an update on the FBI's investigation of Secretary Clinton. What I want to do is tell you what we're recommending. But first, let me tell you what we found. 110 emails, 52 email chains have been determined to contain classified information.
What difference at this point does it make?
8 of those chains are top secret. 36 of those chains secret. And 8 contain confidential information.
What difference at this point does it make?
Everything I did was admitted. There was no law, no regulation.
Secretary Clinton should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation.
I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email.
None of these emails should have been on any kind of unclassified system, not even Gmail.
But first of all, nothing was marked classified.
To the contrary.
Nothing was marked classified.
There is evidence
of a tremendous amount of classified.
Now let me tell you what we found.
Oh my gosh.
110 emails.
It was not the best choice.
52 email chains.
It was a mistake.
Have been determined to contain classified information.
What difference at this point does it make?
8 of those chains were top secret.
Was it the best choice?
6 of those chains.
I said it was a mistake.
8 contained confidential information.
What difference at this point does it make?
With respect to our recommendation, this is going to be an unusual statement in at least a couple of ways. Although there is evidence, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. I know there will be intense public debate. I know there will be intense public debate. I know there will be intense public debate. Public debate. What difference at this point does it make? 110 emails.
It wasn't the best choice.
52 email chains.
I made a mistake.
Have been determined to contain classified information.
What difference at this point does it make?
8 of those chains were top secret.
It was not a good choice.
6 of those chains.
I said it was a mistake.
And 8 contained confidential information.
I'll tell you what, that's the best duo, rap duo, since at least third base. You know, I mean, it's no Pop Goes the Weasel, but it's not bad. Well done. Thank you for that. Now you'll, that's a good way to remember it. It's a little bit of an earworm, but remember how the Comey and Clinton thing went for as you watch the Garland and Trump thing unfold.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy off today, heading back from dropping her son off at Georgia Tech. She'll be back tomorrow. You heard my riddle before Mike Scott's newscast. What do Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, and a Cypriot tax driver have in common? What do they have in common? A lot of common sense. Yeah, you don't need it from the expert class, it turns out. Or you don't need to rely for it exclusively from the expert class, perhaps more accurately. Jamie Dimon, in a recent investor call, we should focus on climate. The problem with that is because of high oil and gas prices, the world is turning back on their coal plants. It's dirtier. Why can't we get it through our thick skulls that if you want to solve climate change, it's not against climate change for America to boost more oil and gas? Well, why can't we get it through our thick skulls? Jamie Dimon always hasn't been a compatriot in that effort. Middling rhetoric sometimes from Jamie Dimon with respect to the tax eaters and grifters pushing terrible central planning. But I digress. from Rod Dreher over at American Conservative, talking about writing about his conversation with a cab driver who was taking him to the airport in Cyprus. He was in Larnaca, to be specific. As we drove in this, the tax driver engaged Dreher, and he's talking about what's happening in Cyprus, the negative impact of the Russian invasion and the EU response on Cyprus with respect to Russian tourists and so forth. But it was more than that. As we drove, Dreher writes, he, the taxi driver, pointed to the smokestack on top of a hill. Dirty smoke rose from it. You see that? They're burning dirty oil there for power. They are poisoning the environment. Because of the sanctions, the European Union gave us permission to buy any oil we can find to make electricity. Our government is getting the cheapest oil they can. It's dirty. The EU gave permission not to use the scrubbers. It's a war thing. So we're destroying our own environment to punish the Russians. Idiots. I have never seen such idiots. Taxi driver in Cyprus and the CEO of one of the world's largest bank. And can't get a Democrat socialist to listen. Not even Senator Sinnemann. John Tamney joins us now, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and author of When Politicians Panic. John, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, thanks so much for having me on.
How about Jamie Dimon and that taxi driver in Cyprus? It's encouraging at one level and discouraging at another level in terms of what the policy choices we see being made regardless.
Yeah, it's encouraging that there's some kind of recognition that just the consumption of oil isn't of itself some sort of negative thing. I guess the way I see it is that oil is a statement of the obvious. It's the ultimate alternative fuel. And so I don't need Jamie Dimon to make me feel good or bad about it. And I don't need government to do it either. Let's not forget that during a presidency of someone who was pro the oil business, George W. Bush, we paid enormous prices for gasoline. During Obama's presidency, which I don't think he was a big fan of oil and gas, the prices were lower. I think the focus has got to get back to on why oil is expensive, and it's not because of scarcity, it's because of dollar policy.
Yeah, well, and frankly, environmental policy too. I mean, for example, refining capacity, since that's become an issue in this inflationary environment.
Well, I wonder, was Bill Clinton a big oil guy? But oil hit $10 a barrel quite a number of times during his presidency. Conversely, Ronald Reagan was very much for the notion of oil consumption, but it was the industry was dead during his presidency because oil got so cheap under him, it fell all the way to $8 a barrel. What's the common denominator between Reagan and Clinton? They didn't devalue the dollar. What is the common denominator in the 21st century? We've had a weak dollar much of this time. And so to me, all this other stuff is just talk. We have expensive oil for a reason. It has nothing. I don't think it has much to do with environmental policy.
Okay. I mean, I know it's a singular focus on the dollar devaluation. I agree with that. But there are other policies and other variables that matter too. Not to mention just philosophically the sort of central planning that is exemplified by determining. Determining a business's method of operation. And you see this playing out right now with the command for more refining and the removal of petroleum from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that is being sold on the global market because we don't have the refining capacity here for it.
Well, but does it matter? We don't have the capacity for a lot of things, but we just import it. Let's not forget that in the 80s and 90s, we imported the vast majority of our oil. Were Americans up in arms, losing sleep at night?
No, but that's not the point.
But it is the point.
No, it's not. The point is, why would you not be opposed to central planning here, artificially limiting the ability of domestic oil companies to refine the product here because of ridiculous environmental regulations. Why would you be? We haven't built a refinery here in 50 years.
I'm very opposed to it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm opposed to anything that limits the markets, but I'm also opposed to Americans suffering devaluation of the dollar they earn such that it's actually economic to drill here. Let's not forget that in the 80s and 90s, there wasn't much of a domestic oil industry. Was that because of regulations? I think not.
No, but no, that's there right. Wasn't... I agree with that. But my point is to say, I agree. And so those companies will be subject to the vagary of the markets as well. But that's not why we have the landscape we have.
Well, I think you ignore that it is a huge factor in why we have the landscape we have. The simple truth is there's not a lot of investor appetite for American exploration right now. And that's not because Biden. Look, Biden's a complete idiot. Let's get that out of the way.
Yeah.
Total empty suit moron, settled science. But the reason there's skepticism, can we look back to lockdowns? Can we look back to 2020? Who was president then? Oil briefly hit -37 a barrel. You think that doesn't factor into the unwillingness of investors to put capital to work? And so when I hear the other side say, oh, Saudi Arabia, drill more, I think, God, you fools, you have zero sophistication. It costs a lot of money to extract oil. But when I hear it from our side saying, oh, drill, baby, drill, it's just so simple. No, actually, it's not. You are risking bankruptcy if you extract oil at one price only for it to command a different price later on.
Absolutely.
And so to leave out the role that lockdowns play, to leave out the role that dollar policy plays, since it's the biggest factor in the price of oil, I think is to have a discussion that's not serious.
Well, I'm not leaving those issues out whatsoever. I opposed the lockdowns from Jump Street just like you did. Speaking of which, this is real shocking. We needed a study on this. Fed study, ending pandemic unemployment aid spurred substantial rise in employment. I love the Fox Butterfield stories out there that remind us that incentives matter.
There's no doubt that if you pay people a lot to not work, they're probably not going to work. I would say that there's a bigger factor, I think, at work here. And again, you and I were against the lockdowns, and we discussed this at the time, what this meant for people overnight. Suddenly their work was meaningless. And particularly in restaurants, there are very few waitresses that are married to a doctor or chefs that are married to a lawyer. And this is important because can you blame people for not wanting to jump back into some of these service fields after what government did to them? Is it a surprise that restaurants still are having trouble with staffing issues, regardless of what government's doing, because they're fearful of going back into an industry that government can overnight destroy, which is what they did? And so I hear you. I don't want government involved in anything. But boy, when we act like these workers are just lazy in the hardest working country on earth, I find that really insulting. Because it's not just laziness. They had their livelihood taken from them by Republicans and Democrats. And can you blame them for not going back into these fields?
Yeah, so then what's your handle? How do you look at the situation here where we've got negative growth but full employment with a relatively low labor participation rate? I mean, how do you suss that all out? This seems to be one of the conundrums that everybody's trying to figure out what it means.
Well, let's never forget, there's an old story about Bosnia in the late 90s when there was war there. And so the New York Times report was that it was 75% unemployment. But anyone who was there saw that all they did was work. And if you go to Bangladesh today, guaranteed it's 100% labor force participation, regardless of what the statistics say. To some degree, we have low labor force participation because we're the richest country on earth. The richer you get, the more that people can divide up work or do less work. I think that is an unsung factor here. But I would just add, I think GDP is an incredibly worthless number. This is a number that rises the more government spends, which is a sign that GDP is a monument to double counting. The growth happened, hence government spending. Government spending can't cause growth. Government spending is a consequence of it. This is a number that also rises if we import less, when in fact imports are the surest sign that your economy is growing, that the world's lining up to meet your needs. This is a number that goes up if we bail out some loser company, which we did back in 2008, and put them back in operation. that actually increases the number, even though by definition, when you bail out what the markets didn't want, you are slowing the economy. And so I think the challenge is in focusing on a number that's very meaningless. I'd rather focus on the stock market.
And so, okay, so then what's, so the 30-day rally tells you what?
I think it speaks to optimism about the future. Again, this is not some endorsement of Joe Biden or anything, but it's I think this was the market's way of saying that, yeah, that some of this legislation the past week was really dunderheaded. Of course it is. By definition, it's going to be. But relative to what they wanted, it's in a sense a relief. All Americans know how to do is grow. We're the most ambitious, enterprising people on earth. And so I don't think we've gotten anything of note from this empty suit of a president that's going to destroy the greatest growth engine on earth. And so my expectation is that we continue to grow. Will there be mistakes? Of course there will be. Politicians, by definition, when they do things, make mistakes. But, you know, Americans progress. They're enterprising.
What's your prognosis on the stickiness of high inflation, which is, you know, something else that Jamie Dimon and others are suggesting, just because we had that slight decline in increase between June and July doesn't mean that we're out of the woods, even as people are, and the market is saying they think that the combination of the Fed and as you said, American ingenuity addressing supply chain issues is going to stick the landing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the Fed's ability to do anything with regard to inflation is vastly overrated. As far as the higher prices, I think you've heard me rant about this before, but I think that still to this day, the greatest book ever written was Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations. And think about what he basically begins the book with. One man working alone can maybe produce one pin a day. Several men working together can produce tens of thousands. Is it any surprise then that prices are much higher today? After what happened in 2020, when there were trillions of working relationships, cooperation developed around the world, only for it to be eviscerated by idiot politicians. I mean, I don't think there's any surprise, but see, that's not inflation. That was command and control foisted on us only to eviscerate beautiful, miraculous global cooperation. So to me, of course, prices are going to go down, but it takes time. And so when I hear people say, oh, well, it's inflation, I hear people showing how they don't understand what inflation is.
Well,
inflation is the devaluation of the currency, and we haven't seen that at least in 2021 and 2022.
Well, you can call it price increases if you want, but the question remains when you're talking about, and this was when it comes to things like the chips for all the products we need, microchips, and at least initially, sort of maybe like around the beginning of this year, you were talking about, yeah, trying to reestablish those supply chains that were destroyed, as you describe. And that was, you know, a 2 or 3 year project, depending on the sector. So it's people trying to figure out, can I expect to see these 15% and 20% price increases on everyday items persist for a year, 2 years, 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise you in total, because let's remember, these supply chains were built by individuals over decades. And so suddenly they're ripped apart. Suddenly institutions and companies that had workers didn't have them. Remember, all these people around the world lost their jobs, even the United States for a brief time. I think, 50 million jobs have been lost, or 25, some enormous number. To rebuild that overnight, and it just shocks me. Look, I get that politics are at play here. But what if Trump were president today? Would this all be inflation? And I'm not saying this about you. You've always been a fair player on this. But what about all the other people saying, oh, well, you know, it's just inflation? To me, that's more insulting than Obama's you didn't build that. Because it presumes that when you lock someone down for months and lock institutions down for months, that all that they were going to do if they hadn't been locked down was just surplus. Oh, it didn't really matter. Actually, it does matter. Everything in the world is the result of remarkable, miraculous global cooperation. So to pretend that you're free again after we took it away, that it's just going to come back online anytime soon, I think is obnoxious. And I hate that our side is making that argument. I think we should be realistic about this, that what they did was unspeakable and it's going to take time. The difference is that's not inflation. Command and control is not inflation. Inflation is devaluation of the currency. Let's define words properly.
John Tamney, editor of RealClearMarkets.com, director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks, and author of When Politicians Panicked, about the topic we were just discussing, COVID and the lockdowns. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. You joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.